to Up Nerd. This is the variety show. I am not alone. I am joined by Mr. Ryan Clark again. You have not been here since the Punisher, King of Killers. Say hello.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, everyone. Oh, that's me, right. So, we're here to discuss The Fade Out. This is a 2016 comic series. It was 12 issues, a miniseries, written by Ed Brubaker, drawn by Sean Phillips, and then the colors were done by Elizabeth Breitenweiser. This book is a noirish crime drama, you could say. We follow our main character, our point of view character, Charlie Parrish. He is a writer in 1948 Hollywood. So this is just after World War II. And we follow him after he awakens from a blackout, only to discover the latest starlet from his studio dead in the room near him. Her name, by the way, is Valerie Summer. From there, we go through an eclectic, I will say, cast of a number of different characters in what amounts to a whodunit against the backdrop of 1948 Hollywood, which is very important because, again, it is post-war and also the threat of communism is alive and well during this time. I guess I want to start with the setting too. The backdrop, I do want to say, is obviously intentional. Ed Brubaker, yeah, the writer, has spoken and talked about the fact that this was inspired by stories he was told by family.
That not even just stories told by his family, but like his uncle. Yeah, I believe it's his uncle was a scriptwriter.
Yeah.
Around this time, and he discovered some of his old scripts and kind of fell in love with them. So this is like kind of a love letter to that time.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful love letter. This book is fantastic. This is not going to be spoiler free. I would encourage people to read this if you have any interest and then come back to the podcast.
We'll try not to say who actually done it, because it is a murder mystery. We don't want to give away the murder mystery. we'll try to leave at least that out.
I want to bring up the setting, though, because to be blunt, I feel like the setting in the hands of a lesser writer could have become the message to it, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense. It's 1948, and Hollywood is rife with exploitation. It's rife with misogyny, it's rife with assault, and all of those things could have been used as some sort of commentary or a takedown of an era that was 70 years ago or something that is essentially pointless. But no, it's really just a backdrop here. And I don't know, I appreciated that. I appreciated the fact that it was never used in the story to prove a point about how bad things are or that sort of thing. It just exists. It wasn't a focal point to show certain things or to try to step over the line or anything. And I liked the setting. And if you were to tell me that this was going to be the setting, I feel like that's a concern I would have, that it would just sort of go out of control, especially on the misogyny aspect.
Yeah, it never really steps over the line. Like, there's definitely a lot of instances of racism and of misogyny in this, but it never goes too hard in those directions.
Yeah, it wasn't off-putting in terms of reading. It just read as realistic for the setting.
Yeah, absolutely. I love this setting in stories in general. 40s LA crime noir stories, I absolutely adore. It's literally one of my favorite things. Like, I love LA Noir, the video game. LA Confidential is one of my favorite films. You put something in 1940s LA and I'm there. I mean, I enjoy myself while I'm there because there have been plenty of instances where that setting has not translated into a good film. Look at Gangster Squad. That's not a great film. Thought it was going to be. It wasn't. But it's there's something about the hard edge of a crime slash noir slash murder mystery set against the sunny, bright slash starry-eyed view of Hollywood in that at that time, which at that time was very much a land of magic. You know, there's something about the dark edge just opposed against that is very alluring to me personally.
I think that aspect's captured really well in this too. We're introduced to everything through Charlie Parrish. He is our sort of main point of view through most of this. He has been working in Hollywood as a writer for some time and is exceptionally jaded. And honestly, one of the biggest problems he has is he has PTSD from his time during the war, where he actually covered the war because he went overseas to be in the war.
With Clark Gable.
Yeah. His time there has trying to go back to Hollywood and make the adjustment is just not something he's able to do, combined with Hollywood and what it's become. So the other sort of central character to this, aside from our murder victim, yeah, there's a award you want, aside from Valerie Summer, is Charlie's best friend, Gil Mason. Gil was also a writer. However, he's been blacklisted by Hollywood because he's a filthy red, quote unquote. The truth is a little more complicated, but Gil continues to work through Charlie. Charlie is fronting as the writer ever since he came back from the war. He hasn't been able to write anything. People don't know this. But Gil's been doing the writing, and Charlie's been passing it off as his own.
Yeah, essentially, Charlie's a typist.
Yeah, Gil is an alcoholic. He is married, has children, and is, I was about to say a functional alcoholic, but he's really not.
No, Charlie's a functional alcoholic.
Yeah.
And even that's borderline, because he is blackout drunk through a lot of this story.
Yeah, I mean, we opened with one of his blackouts. Again, when Charlie awakens, he doesn't remember the night. He vaguely remembers leaving with Valerie, who is your sort of typical Hollywood at the time, Hollywood starlet. She's in blonde hair, blue eyes, starring in her big role, which is being written by Charlie. Mm-hmm. We sort of follow everyone throughout this. We follow Charlie as he just tries to move on initially and eventually kind of finds he can't. He ends up telling Gil, who absolutely cannot let it go. For Gil, I think it's just a step too far. They've already taken his livelihood from him. He's already become a drunk with no job. And finding out that somebody killed this woman, because she was found strangled by Charlie, and finding out that somebody killed her and is getting away with it because the studio has decided through their security to cover it up and make it seem as though she committed suicide.
Yeah, Gil doesn't really have any connection to this actress whatsoever. It's mostly he's kind of propelled through this totally through his rage.
Yeah. Indignation.
At the situation and his hatred of what's become of the studio and how his life was destroyed and everything.
Even though he is also largely responsible for it, and so is his drinking.
Oh yeah.
Really, the only message of this is drinking is bad. Don't become an alcoholic. That's the actual message. I was wrong. There is a message to this book. But yeah, and we follow the two of them. It's after Charlie tells Gil that he was there and discovered Valerie and that no, she was actually strangled. The obituaries and all the newspaper reports and everything else are lying, and it was a cover up. And it's at that point that things really kind of get propelled forward for both of them, because Gil just can't let it go. Gil doesn't care what happens to him. He needs to ruin the lives of these people in Hollywood who ruined his life. But through this, I mean, they try to deal with things in different ways. Charlie just kind of initially moves on. And at the beginning, he can't even look or speak to the woman who is brought in to replace Valerie on the picture that he's working on. Her name is Maya.
Sorry, them replacing her is really kind of very much indicative of the system of Hollywood, that they basically cut this actress who dies completely out of the picture and reshoot all of her scenes over again with this new actress.
And that's exactly what they do. And they make it clear a few times that this has been done before. There are similar circumstances. And later on, I mentioned the security. Well, the studio security is Phil Brodsky. He is, I hesitate to say I like him, but he's an awful human being. But he relates stories that he's done this in the past. He has, quote, set things right, unquote, and course corrected for different mistakes by people.
He's a fixer.
Yeah, he's Mike Ehrmantraut from Breaking Bad.
Yeah, he's Ray Donovan. He's the guy that hushes things up.
And he makes it clear that he's done this before, and he is fully prepared to do it again as the book goes on, and in fact does so a few times as the book goes on. Central to this, though, is that really until fairly late in the book, Charlie is fully prepared to move on from all of this. He has kind of resigned himself and doesn't want to upset what little he has left in life. Charlie is a single man who, whether he wants to admit it or not, he is an alcoholic, but also he is in love with Gil's wife.
Is he? I don't know. I never really got that sense. Like, they have, they definitely have it. They have an intimacy.
They have a thing.
I don't know that he's really in love with his wife.
That's true.
They don't dwell on it a lot. There's definitely an interplay there. You know, you kind of find out what kind of caused a bit of a rift between Charlie and Gil.
He does care for her, though, and we see that.
Oh, yeah, very much. Yeah.
His care for Gil, some of it is out of guilt, because he knows that Gil's spiral, he is partially responsible for.
Yeah.
And if anything happens to her or the kids, it's on him.
I always found by reading it that Charlie was more in love with, I don't want to say he wasn't even really in love with Valerie Summers, but he was in love with the idea of her. And he was in love with, he's more in love with her now that she was taken out of the world.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know why. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And much like the studio does, though, he replaces that with Maya later on because he has a fling with her. And it's somewhere around that point that he discovers Gil has continued investigating on and just couldn't let it go. Combined with he sees and has conversations with Valerie in his mind.
Yeah.
And it's combined with his looking after Gil just kind of pushes him over the edge, and he decides to sort of make that leap into, well, okay, I am also going to investigate these people.
I chuckle when you say investigate, because they're both incredibly inept at investigating.
Yeah, that's
like,
true.
It's if you want to read about how not to investigate a murder, you should read this, because they screw up at almost every single opportunity.
And through this, and through what we've talked about already, we have a pretty diverse cast of characters. We have everybody from, there's Errol Rath, who is the sort of leading man of the film Charlie is working on, but he's also Charlie's friend. And he also seems to legitimately care for Charlie as well, too. But he is also a suspect at the same time.
Yeah, Charlie and Earl have an interesting relationship, because you kind of expect Earl to be very dismissive of Charlie because you know he's a writer.
Just a writer. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's the big Hollywood star, but they actually have a friendship.
Yeah, he's one of the few friends I think Charlie has in this.
Yeah.
Charlie is, most of the characters in this are broken people in one way or another. Some of them are genuine and know what they are, like, say, Phil Bernowski, the studio security, or Earl as well, too, actually. I mean, Earl Rath knows who he is. He knows he's the star. He's a womanizer. He uses his fame to kind of get what he wants, but he's okay with that.
Yeah, because that's part of the machine, really, right, at that time.
He's been put on that pedestal, and he doesn't mind. I mean, what else can he do, either?
Yeah, he's such a big star that the studio makes more money renting him out to other studios for their pictures.
Yeah, than actually using him in a movie.
Yeah, well, they make their own with him, but they make even more by renting him out. That's how valuable he is to their whole system.
Yeah, we're introduced to, like I say, a number of different characters. You mentioned Dottie Quinn earlier. She is the publicity for the studio. Yes. And she's an important character in that she has contact with really everybody in the entire book.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from maybe Gil, who is essentially persona non grata to all of these people since being blacklisted. Like I mentioned, there's Maya Silver. She is the replacement for Valerie Summer after the murder, and she has her own backstory and things going on regarding her ex-husband, whom essentially sold her to the studio, as that was just something that was done at the time, though. Mm-hmm. They are literally buying and trading in human lives.
It's more pointed towards women being traded. Like, they're very much considered disposable and replaceable.
Although, to be fair, we also have another character that is a little more substantial later on, but there's Tyler Graves. And Tyler Graves is also a Hollywood heartthrob, and he's a new one on the scene, but he's a guy that ends up trapped as well.
Yeah. Because everybody has secrets. So in order to keep people from knowing the truth about Tyler Graves, they put him in a relationship. They fix him in a relationship with Maya Silver in order to keep any kind of, at the time, impropriety secret as best they can. That's as best as I could say without being super specific.
This is a really well done book because we have all these moving parts. I've listed, I would say, most of the major characters, minus the studio heads who become more prominent later on. But we have all these moving parts, and it's easy to tell everybody apart in the book.
Yeah.
They all have very different motivations. They all have very different characterization. Nobody feels like anybody else.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
It's a very impressive use of having a large cast. Again, like, I fully recommend this book. Definitely read it. If it seems like that's too many people to follow, well, good news, because the start of each volume has a little sort of primer on who everybody is. Which I really appreciate when books do that. It's happening more and more, especially some of the books that have a cast that is four or five times this. But it's kind of nice to just get that little refresh in between volume.
Yeah. And it's very much different from most other, like, Hollywood crime noirs, in that a lot of it is very much about movie making at the time. It's a lot of it is about the studio system, and Charlie has to do rewrites every single night because the director is an old nutcase who just is never satisfied and constantly wants changes. It's not like your standard it's not like your standard 40s/ depression to post-war noir, Los Angeles noir. Like you're not following a hard-boiled detective. You're not following a gangster. You're following this inept writer.
Yeah, you're following two alcoholics who are doing this in one way or another just because of a feeling they have of impotence at this point.
Yeah, for sure.
And they get on this track and neither of them knows how to get off. Frequently, Charlie refers to himself as a coward, and he kind of is. He gets dragged along or dragged into this to a certain extent, but he can never either fully commit to it, nor can he ever break the path that he's on. And he talks about, too, that kind of sums up his life. You know, he ended up going to war just to follow Clark Gable around, essentially. It was really well done. Like I say, every character feels fully fleshed out. And it feels like throughout this, it does what good detective stories or good noir stories do. And then as they ask themselves, what would this character do at this point? Like when confronted with this, what would this character do? And it's when you can answer that well, that you can write a character study really well.
Yeah.
There's no moments where you go, well, okay, well, he wouldn't do that, or this doesn't seem realistic. It's told very coherently at the same time, too, which I appreciate. The flashbacks are well placed when there are flashbacks. I appreciate that they wait until we know these characters reasonably well before feeding us significant backstory. So, for example, we learn that Charlie was once married. And we don't see them until the third volume.
Yeah, and we don't even really hear that much about why his marriage dissolved.
Yeah, he mentions, again, it's the sort of like, oh, I'm a coward, I always did the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. Charlie has a lot of self-loathing.
Yeah. One of the things I think this book does really well is that, this is going to sound really basic, but it's important to me as a fan of like murder mysteries and stuff, is that it piecemeals out the information along the way. You're never ahead of the main character. You're finding out the information at the same time as Charlie is, or Gil, because they're basically on the same track. Because I utterly hate it when you're watching a cop story or something and you know information before the detective does. And Charlie's not a detective, but he is in that role in this story. It bothers me every single time to watch the cop catch up to us as the audience. I hate it, hate it, hate it, hate it. The only time I've ever seen it done well is Poker Face, the streaming show on Peacock, which the redhead whose name is escaping me. It's Ryan Johnson's show. Natasha Lyonne. There it is. It came to me. That is done in a different is where it's in a done in such a way that you know who did it, but watching them find it out is done in a different way where it's fun to do that, as opposed to something like Mr. Mercedes, which is a show that I stopped watching because I was tired of watching. I was tired of watching the detective like try to catch up to me. I hated it. So one thing, yeah. So like I said, the thing I like most about this as a mystery is that you find things out very, it's plotted extremely well.
No, that's true. We're fed things. And part of that is because we follow Charlie directly. It is very rare that we see things from other character points of view. And when we do, it's not scenes that completely give away anything. It just adds more to those characters or to what's going on. It's nothing that's integral to the story necessarily, but is integral to those characters.
Yeah, those stories are kind of like they move the plot forward, but not so much that you like the main character is lost. They mostly just shed light on who this character is as a person. Like the scenes with Dottie doing her job, the scenes with Brodsky doing his job, you know, going to a meet at a bar, waiting around for some blackmailer to show up, you know, doing that sort of thing.
And all of those are important too, to understand the procedure with the studio and how things operated at that time, or how things operated during what is essentially a crisis for all of these characters at this point. I do think the only sort of negative I have, and it's not a negative, would be, and I'm going to try really hard not to give anything away.
You can give a spoiler warning and put a spoiler warning in the link description if you want. You can do it, put a timestamp.
All I'm really going to say is I love the ending. We do find out, presumably, what happens to Valerie, as we do with any sort of good, I think, murder. It is definitely open a little bit, if you want it to be. But we do find things out pretty definitively, I would say. It's not necessarily what I was expecting, but in a good way.
Yeah, it's not really a huge dramatic reveal as much as it is a reveal about... It's very much more a reveal about how the system actually works. And how this is that the system really worked at the time.
Or didn't work, is the depending on your viewpoint. It's not necessarily the climax of the book, I guess. If you were expecting a sequence where everyone is sitting around and there's a ticking grandfather clock and and the detective confronts the murderer, you're not going to get that in this.
No.
There is not necessarily a satisfaction to it either, because it doesn't undo the lives that are destroyed in the process of this.
No, but that's very much indicative of a crime noir where there's...
Yeah, it's also indicative of real life.
Yeah, very much so. Like, you get the satisfaction of knowing what happened, but knowing that it doesn't really... It won't make much of a difference in the grand scheme of things.
And that's what I really like, is that it felt real to the story, too. For some people, I think it's going to be, they're not going to get that cathartic gotcha moment where Frank Castle confronts the villain and shoots him in the head.
Right.
Don't go in expecting that. But this is more of a true to life solution, particularly in the time frame that it's set in. And I feel like it works perfectly. So I think for some, it could be framed as a negative, but overall, I thought it was perfect. I thought, yeah, I don't want to say anything else. I'm giving it away.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree with you there.
No, it hit home really well. And a lot of the reason why a lot of this book hits home well, and this is why I wanted to single out the creators early on too, but in particular, the colorist.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned her name before.
Elizabeth Breitwiser.
Yeah, Elizabeth Breitwiser does an incredible job. Sean Phillips is good. He is an excellent artist. His artwork works extremely well in this book, but it pops because of Elizabeth's work.
Yeah, for sure.
The way that the colors are used in terms of to draw attention to certain things, I'm trying to think, it reminds me a lot of, this is going to be a weird one, but hey, it reminds me a lot of the original Crow movie in that it is it's very much darker tones throughout it. And so when you do get things interspersed, like say Maya in a red dress, or something like that, it really pops with all the blues and the black and that kind of thing. I think stuff like that helps it. I think the coloring and the lack of coloring, I think, in some of the flashbacks or the ghost scenes or Charlie's blackout scenes when he's trying to remember, and you get these almost silhouettes of people. I think that's all really well done. Like, I like Sean Phillips' art. I think he's an excellent artist, but I really feel like it's the colorist on this that brings out a lot of it.
Yeah, I would agree. And a lot of his, they're not working together anymore. They did a few pieces of work together, and I think she's moved on to other, I don't know if it's other projects or other just another line of work. I'm not sure. I think she had like a something personal happen that made her step away. I could be wrong about this. It's been a long time since I read about it, but his stuff right now is being colored by his son, Jacob Phillips. What they're doing together is completely different from most, but also still very, very good. And it varies from book to book. So like the Reckless series is colored in a very different way from Night Fever, which is what came after that. And that was very different from Where the Body Was, which is what came after that. I realize there's not a lot of insight in what I just said, but
you look at a lot of titles. That's good.
Yeah. Sticking to the color, like there's a whole lot of different tonal changes and multi-tones in this in every single page. And that's very different from if you look at the very early criminal issues, those are way different from this and don't have nearly the same kind of depth. And the inks are a lot heavier in those issues than they are here. So like this is some of the best looking work that they've done.
I really think this might be some of Phillips' best work too, again, partially because of the coloring. I will say this, and this is a debate we've had or briefly had, but didn't want to get into. I think in terms of writing, this might be Ed Brubaker's best work. And that is, for anyone who knows Ed Brubaker as a writer, that is a substantial compliment. He has written Criminal, which is an excellent series. He has written Pulp, which was a great one shot. He probably most notably, or people would most know him for The Winter Soldier. He established that character during a Captain America run, which ran for a significant amount of time.
Yeah, really long time. He wrote a lot of that book.
And then Gotham Central.
Yeah, that's a series that we need to do an episode on, because I will talk about Gotham Central to anyone who will listen.
I would too. I mean, it is an amazing series. It's interesting because they were able to do sort of noir combined with police procedural, but set within a comics universe.
Yeah.
Even reading something like The Fade Out made me appreciate how difficult that would be. I think even more to try to work within those constraints. But here, where he's without any constraints really whatsoever, I mean, this book is magic. If you like books, you should read this. This is one of a handful of books I would just fully recommend to people outside of comics.
Yeah. So Brubaker, Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips are probably my favorite writer artist team. I get literally every single thing they do, even if they put two pages into an image compilation book. I'm buying that book.
I'm going to write a carefully worded letter to Michael Lark on your behalf.
I'm not saying that they're not great with other writers. I just like Brubaker and Phillips. Those are my guys.
Yeah.
And I have other favorite creators. You know, you and I talked off the air for a few minutes about Darwin Cook. He's my all-time favorite creator because that's a very different thing than this.
Wow, another one. All right. Dear Greg Rucka, this is what Ryan said about you.
And I also love Greg Rucka. Shut up. And I also love Garth Ennis. Shut up. So when this book was initially announced, this was the first book where Brubaker and Phillips signed a big deal at Image Comics. And they got a deal where they had moved all their stuff because they were producing stuff. He was working for hire through Marvel, And that's where he was at. We're like writing Captain America, and he was doing his creator-owned stuff at their Icon imprint, which doesn't really exist anymore. And that's sad. But, and eventually Icon was pretty much just Ed Brubaker. But they moved over to Image and got this deal where they basically had complete creative freedom. They could do literally whatever they wanted. And this was the first book that they put out. And I remember when it was announced that they were doing a 40s Hollywood noir. And I said how much before, how much I love 30s to 40s Hollywood noirs. It's like, I was like, this book is made specifically for me. It's like the universe wanted me to have this. It's Brubaker and Phillips writing a Hollywood 40s noir. This is perfect. This is for me specifically.
What's funny is that Brubaker would probably agree with you because he has talked a number of times that he was terrified doing this because he didn't think there would be an audience. Yeah. And of course, in the end, it has turned out to be his highest selling work outside of obviously the superhero stuff. But I mean, he doesn't own Captain America. So
that's kind of surprising because I know a lot of his book, a lot of his stuff that they're doing now, because they've basically moved into doing just original graphic novels. It started as an experiment with pulp. And then they did a small one that ties in called My Heroes Have Always Been Junkies, which tied into the criminal universe. I hate to say universe, but it's, you know, it's what it is. And then they started the Reckless series, which are just one-shot graphic novels, like a pulp hardback type thing. And those, from what I read, because I subscribe to his newsletter, is those do extremely well. And those are in bookstores. And they're doing very well, not just in comic markets, but in book markets as well. So I'm kind of surprised that this is still, like, I'm not surprised because this is a fantastic book, but I'm kind of surprised that that is its bestseller, considering how well the new stuff is doing.
It's been reissued a number of times. There's different ways to pick it up. Personally, I read this in the format of its three trade paperbacks. You can now find it in a single collected trade paperback. You can get it in a single collected hardcover if you're a crazy person who reads hardcovers all the time.
I have it. I was collecting it at the time.
I can't carry them into the bathroom easily. All right.
No, this is a sit down and maybe have a table in front of you book.
But in any case, yeah, it's been collected a number of times. It won the Eisner for 2016's Best Comic Miniseries, which well-deserved. So I think that helped its status a lot. And since then, too, I still see it brought up in different sort of mediums or lists. So, I mean, Comic Book Herald, top 500 graphic novels of all time, and then in parentheses, that I've read. But anyway, it appears quite high on that. I think things like that help. And frequently, if you see sort of top 10 lists of different things, like top 10 mysteries, or even on occasion, top 10 graphic novels or things like that, you'll see it show up. So I think that helps a lot. I think it's highly reviewed on Amazon in terms of a lot of people have reviewed it. So I think things like that kind of help its visibility as well, too.
Yeah.
It's such a good story. I heard about it, I'm pretty sure, from you.
Probably.
And I purchased it issue by issue, but I mean, that is an excruciating way to read this. The people who get to read it now as sort of one set, I am jealous of, because I find it reads really easily. And this is another thing I wanted to get into. So initially, when I wanted to do this, I picked up the first issue and then just could not put it down.
The first soft cover, you mean?
The first soft cover, which is the first four issues of the comic series. And then just had to continue on. So anyway, fast forward to, we're finally getting around to recording it. I blew through it in under 24 hours again. I'm just curious, how the heck do you read this and put it down at all? I think you did. It took you longer.
Yeah, I read it basically like the first six issues. I read it the first half to first half. And I got tied up with other stuff. because I've read this a number of times.
Yeah, I still remembered it, but I mean, I have fade out dreams if I do, you know, graphic novel 1 and 2 and then go to bed or something like that. I just,
yeah,
it stays with me. And I really like that. There's a handful of comics that I read and just stick with me each time, no matter how many times I've read them. And this is on that list. I can only think of a couple other ones. And I mean, they're substantial ones as well, too. So 11 out of 10, one of the best books I have read. Not just comic books. I mean, we talked about King of Killers previously, and I enjoyed it quite a bit. It's not in the same realm as this. And granted, I mean, they are two completely different things.
I wouldn't even try to compare the two to each other.
It's apples to oranges, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
It's also kind of leagues ahead one of the other. So this is a great book.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't already, pick it up, read it, reread it. Don't live it.
Yeah. And if you like it, I would actually recommend, if you can find it, there's a... just to see kind of see that book in a slightly different format. The first issue was printed with a special like magazine sized variant. So it has very much, it has like a, it's in a larger page format, even larger than the hardcover, which is larger than the soft cover. And I think even larger than the single issues, but it's basically magazine style. So it kind of feels like an old Life magazine. I'm sure those must be very hard to come by, but if you can track one of those down, I'd recommend that, because they did one of those for this, and they also did a couple of criminal specials in that format, and those are very, very cool.
This ran from 2014 to 2016, so it was over the span of 2 full years, and reading it in the individual issues was tough. So thankfully, now that it's out, I can definitely recommend it. We'll see. At some point, he being Ed Brubaker, has received calls about adapting it, but who knows?
Yeah, but they're working on the criminal TV series right now. That's actually happening.
Yeah, he's busy with that. And then
that's going to be on Amazon.
This was fantastic. And I'm glad you were able to come on and do this. You're right. We should definitely do Gotham Central at some point. That'll be something in the future.
Yes.
Yeah, I do know at some point we're going to do the Punisher films together. And I have a feeling that we're going to differ on those, because I am a lot less big on them, I think, than you are.
Well, I don't blindly love them, but
I'm not saying you should either. Yeah.
And I don't know. Our mutual friend Jody has taught me to appreciate more of the positive things about a film than just hating something that's technically bad.
You don't hate anything either. I think that's the thing. Age has helped a lot with that. All right. Where can the people find you?
They can find me on Instagram, on Threads, and Blue Sky at Mr. Ryan Clark. Although Instagram's really my main. I do action figure photography and mini reviews. I just today put up Instagram reel of G.I. Joe Classified Big Boa, which is a fun boxing guy with a super duper stormtrooper helmet on his head. It's goofy as hell, and I think he's fantastic. So I also recently did some photos of the Secret Empire Captain America figure, which is not a great comic story, but ends up being a really good action figure.
You know, the best character with a stormtrooper helmet was, of course, the Taskmaster. So
you consider that a stormtrooper helmet?
It was. It was the stormtrooper helmet that was bedazzled. That is not the Marvel Comics Taskmaster. I am referring to WCW Wrestling.
Shockmaster.
I need to.
That's why I was.
To edit out my
Shockmaster. No, this is staying in. I'm I'm putting the rule in place now. This stays in. The shock monster is a spectacular failure with a bedazzled stormtrooper
head. One of the greatest debuts of all time. If you want to correct Up Nerd Podcast, you can find us via email, upnerdpodcasts@gmail.com. We can be found on Blue Sky, upnerdpodcast.bsky.social, Twitter @upnerdpodcast, or X, or whatever it's called this week.
You sound very reluctant to be on Twitter.
I do not enjoy it. Every time I go on, it is just a fresh new disaster. And lastly, we have Facebook, where thankfully I am not old enough to be on Facebook a whole lot. So we are Up Nerd Podcasts on Facebook. Anyway, feel free to seek us out in any of those ways. And yeah, thanks again for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me, man.
I hope everybody out there has a good day and be good to you.